Hello and welcome to Football Memories and Moments. Basically, we've interviewed people who all share one thing, a love of football. In this podcast, we find out their favourite memory, something personal to them, and a moment that stands out forever. We hope you enjoy, and if you do, please like, subscribe and rate. We're joined this week by the commentator Jim Proudfoot, and I've been lucky enough to build up a bit of a contact and rapport with Jim, and Jim's basically one of the hardest working commentators around, and right across the board, and sees a lot of good football. He's worked across World Cup finals, he's done England games, he's one of the best out there, and he's a bloody good bloke to boot as well. And I was lucky to meet Jim in Liverpool. He'd been up to see Everton play Lyon as part of one of his commentating gigs, and I was delighted to finally meet him, having spoken to him for a while over the course of a few years now, actually, just to finally meet him and have a sit down and have a good chat about his beloved Torquay. I'm assuming he's going to have a word with his cleaners at the hotel he was staying at, because I think at one point some dust did actually get in his eye, which was great to see. He very much got across his love for Torquay United as his memory, and it's an interesting day. You can catch on YouTube quite a lot of what Jim is talking about, the highlights from his memory, which is Barnet versus Torquay in the last day of the 2000-2001 season. They are on YouTube, and you can get a sense of the sense of occasion that Jim felt on the day. And also as well, his moment was, while still was a personal to him, it was a professional moment. But he, you know, he commentated on with a Manchester United legend in Frank Stapleton, Ryan Giggs' goal in 1999, and it was pretty special listening to Jim talk about it and how it unfolded from his point of view. And it was great to see him, and obviously thanks for Jim, who gave his time up actually to do a pilot of this podcast, and I can't thank him enough. He's a top bloke, and I hope you enjoyed this podcast as much as I enjoyed doing it.
I've gone for Torquay's win against Barnet on the last day of the season in the 2000-2001 season. It was just an extraordinary game, and it had been an extraordinary time leading up to the match itself. Just to paint the picture, Torquay at that stage had never been relegated out of the league. We'd gone into the league in 1927 and had been an ever-present member of the league, and through the 80s had to apply for re-election several times, like Halifax and other clubs that ultimately had been unsuccessful. But Torquay had managed to keep their heads above the water. But we get to the end of this particular season, and there are two sides who could be relegated out of the league. There was only one went down, and it was going to be Barnet or Torquay. For a long time, it looked as though it was going to be Torquay. We'd gone bottom on Good Friday with a hopeless defeat at Carlisle, which I'd been to. And that was soul-destroying, really, to make the journey all the way up to Carlisle, watch them play abysmally, lose, go bottom of the table, and didn't think we'd ever get off the bottom of the table again. But the penultimate weekend of the season, they managed to win. They started stringing a few results together. Colin Lee had come in and had taken over. And it was set up perfectly. The last game of the season was Barnet away, and ultimately, whoever lost was going to be relegated out of the league. And we had the benefit of the draw. So we must have been, I can't remember whether we were a point above them or whether we were level on points and had a better goal difference. But we needed a draw, and they had to beat us in order to relegate us. And obviously in the week leading up to the game, you can't think about anything else whatsoever. You can hardly function at work. There were several aspects to it that occupied your mind, primarily the fact that none of us had tickets. It wasn't an all-ticket game, which sounds bizarre now. I mean, I don't know what the capacity at Underhill was, maybe about 4,500, something like that. But it was you know, several frantic phone calls backwards and forwards. What time are we going to have to get there in order to be able to get in? Because it was just going to be a queuing system. Didn't know any of the players well enough to be high up enough to get a comp, because they'd all got family attending and friends. So just hope for the best, really.
So before we have to get into the game, so that's the scene nicely set for us, that, you know, you've basically had no sleep for a week and you think your club's going out the football league because basically there's no one there to, there's no old pals act to get you back in.
Yeah.
That's the scene set. So you're, from the research I know of you, you're actually, you were born in Birmingham and you've
no,
ended
I was,
up on...
I was born in the West Country, actually.
You're born in the West Country.
But I moved away when I was just after 18 months old. My dad worked in the power industry. He'd been working in the Bristol area, and he relocated, got an office job out of grid control and went to Birmingham. So I was brought up, I don't remember life, you know, in the southwest, the first time around. I moved back, but I don't remember life the first time around down there. So I was brought up in Birmingham, and it would have been easy, I suppose. I really should be a Birmingham City fan, and I've got a real soft spot for them. But Torquay's my team, you know. That's where I associate with. I moved back down there to study to university when I was when I'd left school, and I went back and started watching. So that would have been 1990, and they had a good team. Well, they haven't had many good teams, but they did have a good team then. And me being from Birmingham, they had several young Brummies in and around the squad because they had a very good scouting policy within Birmingham. And they used to be able to pick up the guys who weren't quite good enough to play for Birmingham, but particularly West Brom. So West Brom cast-offs would end up down at Torquay. People like Darren Moore, Paul Hall, and then Adrian Foster, Scott Colcombe. So there was a big Brummie contingent. And I was already working by then. So I would be meeting these guys on a professional basis, and I've just got on really well with them. And so when you've also, they're your team, but then you have an affinity with the actual people involved because you're in a fortunate position to know them, it sort of makes the bond with the club that bit better. So I'd long moved back away from the West Country, chasing work, and been up in the northeast, and sort of settled back in the south by then, in Hampshire. But they were still my club, and those guys had long since gone. But once it's under your skin, it's there. They're then your club.
When did you know that your love for Torquay was absolutely signed, sealed, and delivered?
I was expecting it to be the case, but in my first season, my first year at university. So that first season, I was watching them. I knew straight away. This is perfect. I mean, I was living in Exeter rather than in Torquay, but it was a trip down to Torquay. We invariably had a pretty big night out after the games because they used to play on Friday, so you'd go fall from there straight into the nightclub. Just everything about it was a good experience. And they got to Wembley that first year that I was watching them. I'd never been to Wembley, so they played Blackburn in a playoff final, got absolutely played off the park, and won it on penalties. So it was just that whole experience of a very wide-eyed 18-year-old seeing that. You know, here's my team, and they're playing at Wembley. And there was never any chance that I would have been supporting anybody else. But it was that really first season of living away from home cemented it, because that was the first chance I ever got to watch them on a regular basis.
So you come into this last game, and you've just said there that you were already a professional, as in you were already commentating at the time.
Yeah.
So you had a rising profile and you had an idea. So did you have to turn, something I've never thought of before, but did you have to turn down work that weekend so you could go?
Yes. Yeah.
And is that the best decision you've ever made?
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't have been able to concentrate on work. I mean, my bosses, I'm trying to think where I was working. It's freelancing. In fact, I know what I did. I went in to Sky that night. I probably shouldn't say it. I went into Sky that night and actually commentated on highlights of the game. So I didn't. I didn't lose too much money, but I wouldn't have been able to concentrate on anything else that day. And I proved that that is the case because 3 years later, we got promotion out of the division and we played at Southend. And I didn't take the day off. And I was hopeless. I just couldn't, you know. You see the goals coming in, and we needed to win and Huddersfield not to win to get promotion. Now, they haven't won automatic promotion for 40 years or something stupid. And I don't know why I didn't take the day off that day. I really should. That is a big regret that I didn't. Wasn't at Southend that day. So I know that the decision to go to Barnet was the right one, because I just wouldn't have been able to concentrate on what I was watching.
You were living in Exeter at the time, or were you living?
No, I had moved to Hampshire. I was living just outside Winchester.
Yeah.
I've been sports editor of the local radio station, which was owned by Capital.
Yeah.
So I was on Capital's payroll, and they'd moved me down to Hampshire to run this sort of fledgling department, which I'd loved. It was a wonderful time in my career.
Yeah.
Worked with some great people, made some really good friends. It was a nice part of the world. It was a part of the world I didn't know. Funny enough, my dad had worked there in the 60s, so he knew it a little bit. So he would say, these are the places perhaps to look at, to live. But my best mate was living in Southampton. So I'd moved down there, and I got to the stage where, because I was freelancing, I was commentating on a national basis. So I was my work... day-to-day work was in the office in London, but I could be anywhere at the weekend, so it didn't really matter where I lived. So I just took the opinion, just go and live somewhere where you enjoy it and where your friends are. So I'd moved away when I'd got married, but I moved back down there, and I've been back down there sort of 2 or 3 years. Now, obviously, that meant that I didn't get to see Torquay too often because of work, and because it was quite a schlep. It's cross country, and it's not the easiest journey from Hampshire down there. About 100, and from there it'd been about 130, 140 miles. So I didn't see them that often, and that in a way, it's funny being a supporter. When you see sides on a regular basis, obviously you're a season ticket holder. You pick up the subtleties and difference in individual players' performances that you don't if you see a side 8 or 10 times over the course of the season. But I think if you see a side only 8 or 10 times over the course of the season, it doesn't become, not a chore in going, but it doesn't become a habit, that you appreciate those times that you do see them that little bit more. It's more of an event. And that was the situation I was in, because I was getting in a hugely fortunate position to be getting paid to watch some high quality football. But your team is your team. And so watching Torquay was always the most enjoyable, I suppose, the most enjoyable games I went to.
We'll come to the day then. You take it away from start to finish.
Well, I left home at, I don't know, about 9 in the morning, and got to Barnet at 11. And
that's called making sure, that isn't it? Just make sure.
I thought I'll be first in the queue. There was another guy that worked for Sky that supported them, and so we'd arranged to meet. We'll see you there at 11:30. Got there, parked. There's no parking around Barnet, and the old ground, and found somewhere to park, and walked down to the ground, and I couldn't see the end of the queue, the front end of the queue, which was a bit worrying. So you mentally time up, well, I mean, I think you've probably given us 1,000. Oh, fine, I'm going to be in, I'll be fine. But I was, I don't know, 100, 150 down in the queue 4 hours before kickoff. And they opened the gates at 1:30. So fortunately, it was a nice day. But we were all just all queuing and chatting about the game. And obviously, you've kind of played the game over in your mind 100 times by the time you actually get in. 1:30, the gates open. Everyone paid their money and then raced and sort of literally got through the gate and then ran, not really knowing the configuration. They put a temporary stand up for us, so it would normally have been terracing that end, but they put temporary seats in. I don't know why, because no one sat down, But there were these sort of temporary green seats, and got a great positions behind the goal where it turned out all the action was, and put two or three rows in the front. So it was perfect. It was great, but this stand filled up quite quickly, and it was obvious there were going to be a lot of people locked out. And you ultimately heard stories about a Barnet fan who'd flown in from Australia. His plane had been delayed for an hour, didn't get in. There were people up trees watching the game. So if the crowd, I don't know what the crowd was, I'm guessing, as I say, about 4,500, but there were probably 6,500 people there, I would think. You know, quite a few shut out, but it didn't matter, I was in. Yeah. So that was the only thing that made a difference. Then the team gets announced, and he's changed the keeper, and Colin Lee was the manager, and he put in a lad called Stuart Jones. Now, Stuart had been a decent non-league keeper, and he'd been at Western Supermare, I think, and I think he'd been an apprentice at Sheffield Wednesday. But that was a real shock. Nobody was expecting Stuart to play. So straight away, as fans, you're kind of on the back foot. You're thinking, well, what? I'm not sure about this. It'll be all right. We've got to have faith. He's made his decision, and we'll see what happens. And it turned out that was one of the most iconic decisions, I suppose, in Torquay's history, because he ended up saving a penalty, and it was all a dream, said Colin Lee after the game. He said, "I knew. I just had this dream that he saved the penalty, so I picked him, and he did."
I mean, that works out in the end. But if he'd said that before the game,
it's a hell of a risk.
Yeah, if he'd said that before the game, there may have been a lynching beforehand.
Yeah.
So did the nerves kick in for you? I mean, I think the nerves were ever present, but did the real gripping, ice cold feeling in your stomach, did that kick in when the team was named?
Yes. Because it wasn't that we didn't trust Stuart Jones as a goalkeeper, but it was just the shock of it, and so you're out of your comfort zone. It was a day where you didn't want anything unexpected. A 0-0 draw is just fine. Thank you very much indeed. And already you swap the keepers around, and you're thinking, you just had this sort of feeling of foreboding that it was going to be one of those afternoons where nothing was ever really going to be simple.
Yeah.
And that's how it turned out.
So let's go through the game. I realise we're doing this Chris Grayling thing of so. Take us through the game. How did it actually play out in the end?
Well, by half time we were 3-0, and that was the most extraordinary thing about it. We had gone into the game on a bit of form, probably a bit of better form than Barnet had. But as cynical supporters, and I was cynical enough then, I mean, I'm bad now, but I was cynical enough in my 20s, that I kind of expected that they'd find a way to make a mess of this somehow. There was no feeling of inevitability. Oh, I knew we were going to be all right. I never knew we were going to be all right in this game. Goes without saying, two sides lacking confidence, first goal is going to be absolutely crucial. So the opening exchanges play out, and we're not doing particularly well. And then their keeper gets injured and carried off. And I think it was at that point we thought, and it sounds a terrible thing to say, obviously you wouldn't wish it on him, and I wish we hadn't got the result that way. But at that point, you think, this could be our day.
Yeah.
You know, a little bit of luck. Their goalkeeper was, I can't remember, I think it was Lee Harrison. Apologies if I got that wrong. But he was a good player. And that was a massive, massive boost for us.
Yeah.
And then within 10 or 15 minutes, we scored twice. Jason Rees pinged the left-footed volley in from the edge of the penalty area. And then Kevin Hill, who is Mr. Torquay, ended up playing more games for the club than anyone else in history. He was 5'8" and jumped 8'6". He was an unbelievable player, a real athlete. And it rises at the near post, flicks this corner. We're two up. And we could do, they need to score three now to relegate us. We've still got an hour. We're more than capable of letting in three in an hour. But
that's the spirit.
We're in a better position than any of us really thought we were going to be. They then get a penalty up the other end. So the two goals have happened in front of us. If you're not familiar with Underhill, well, it's old ground. It was a big slope. And we were kicking downhill in the first half, so we'd lost the toss. Barnet always liked to kick down in the second half because it would give them that momentum chasing the game. So we were behind the goal at the bottom of the hill. So we'd seen those two goals. Then at the other end, Jimmy Agri gives away a penalty for handball. And Darren Curry, who was Barnet's other star name, steps forward to take it. And I've had a dream. Stuart Jones dives to his right-hand side, saves this penalty. We're still 2-0 up. And it can't have been long after, 3 or 4 minutes after that, Davy Graham, who, again, ended up being one of the linchpins of the team that got us promoted 3 years later. He'd just come down from Dunfermline at that stage. And he played 2 or 3 games. And he volleys, just makes a brilliant run and volleys one in from close range, right in front of us, and we're three up. And it was only at that stage did I know we were going to be all right. And I've celebrated that goal like I've never celebrated a goal before. And if my throat's sounding a bit hoarse now, it's the abuse of having commentated through 5,000 goals, but primarily having shouted as loudly as I did when he scored. And just a never to be forgotten moment. Funny enough, I watched it again the other day on YouTube, and it just makes the hairs on the back of your neck stand up. And he threw himself into the crowd, and the celebration was just magnificent. So coming up to halftime, we're 3-0 up. We only need a draw. And at that stage, it was, yeah, we're going to be all right. We're going to be all right. But Torquay being Torquay, of course, didn't make life easy. And proceeded to concede twice, including an own goal, in the first 20 minutes of the second half. So at that point, we're holding on. We still could afford to let another one in, but only one more. Barnet had built up all the momentum. And obviously players who, you know, are in a team of 23rd in the league. So that says about how the season has gone. And it wasn't, a lot of the players who were playing that day weren't the ones that had got us into the situation in the first place. The team had been overhauled considerably. But nevertheless, there's not a lot of confidence there. And you can see it, you know, beginning to drain away on some faces. Ryan Green, who'd scored the own goal, was having a bit of a torrid afternoon. Barnet were launching everything high inside the penalty area. And the last 15 minutes lasted about 3.5 hours. But we held on. We didn't concede the third, which I think would have, that could have finished us off. Because I think if Barnet had scored another one, they'd probably have scored the fourth as well. But we hung on. And it's just, it almost brings a tear to the eye now. I mean, it's 16 years ago. But it brings a tear to the eye now, thinking about...
Just to give you an understanding of what Jim means by that, where we're talking, he's spent the last 2 minutes not looking me in the eye, and he's looking wistfully off to his left. And I think when he leaves his hotel, he's going to complain about the dust in the room because he is getting slightly emotional. Just to bring it back to being, you know, a macho hard man. I'm not serious there. When the whistle goes, how what is the emotions running through Jim Proudfoot's mind then?
Well, the emotion running through my mind is fantastic. We've done it. Let's get on the pitch. And just, I'd say we were 2 or 3 rows in the front. So it wasn't an arduous task. It was more of an athlete in those days to be able to clamber over the seats, and you know, adrenaline sort of takes you on there anyway. And the players have run off. I'm not proud of it. Looking back now, a bit horrified really, but 500 went on the pitch. And I got rumbled by my late mum, bless her, was watching Soccer Saturday, and Chris Kamara was at the game doing his cami cam. And so he's doing his piece to camera. You can see all these people on the pitch behind her, and she clocks me. So I get a text. I see you won then. Yeah, we won. Yeah. I liked your black sweater. And it was, oh, okay. And I never really lived that down. But yeah, I was there. And it, as I say, I'm not proud of that, because looking, I know now, after another 15 years of supporting a club that haven't done very well, that we were dancing on the grave of Barnet. And it was inevitable it was going to happen. But it kind of wasn't appropriate, really, because of the fact that we'd sent them down. If it just been that we'd stayed up that day, then fine. And I'm not criticising the behaviour of others, but I'm just looking back at my own, you know, my own. There was an inevitability that there was going to be a pitch invasion. It was a little bit too triumphant, I suppose, looking back. But that's, you know, that's the emotion of the day, and it's easy in the cold light of day to say that now.
Yeah.
The same thing happened at the end of this season, I would probably do the same thing, truth be told, because you just get caught up in the picture, and I don't think I'd be critical of my own sons doing it, but I don't know whether it was the right thing to do, but you know, it happened. I mean, if that's the worst you ever do, I suppose it's not bad as if we sort of started a mass brawl, but it was a bit unedifying, I suppose.
But you're not ruling out again.
Never say never. I'm very fortunate to have been present at quite a few iconic moments through work. But the one that stands out, which was one of the first that I saw that at the time, you knew just how important it was and that it would still be talked about generations on, it was Ryan Giggs' goal in the 1999 FA Cup semi-final for Manchester United against Arsenal in the replay. The famous goal with the famous celebration. And that had been just an extraordinary night, and it was a fitting way, really, for an epic game to be won.
So you're... Where are you then? Why were you there professionally? Were you there personally?
So I, at that stage, I made the decision to go freelance. I'd left Capital Radio, the Capital Radio Group, in 1998. I'd had an opportunity to go freelance because Century Radio in the Northwest had just launched. And I knew the program controller, and they had identified football rights as a way to gain an audience, and had done, you know, a remarkable deal, really, for a station that was new, in buying exclusive rights to Manchester United games, which was a stunning piece of business. I say exclusive, maybe it wasn't exclusive, but anyway, they got this deal, and they got access to do all the Manchester United games, and. As a result of that, I found myself in a fortunate position. It's always when you go freelance, it's you're weighing up the security of the salaried position and the benefits that you have with possibly more money, less benefits, but certainly less security. But here they were offering me every Manchester United domestic game. We didn't do the European games, but every Manchester United domestic game. And that meant that I already knew that I had a proportion of what my existing salary was sorted for the year. And, you know, if it went well, then another year on the back of that. So I jumped at the chance. I was living in, trying to think where it would have been. I was in Staffordshire to start with, and moved to Oxfordshire to be closer to London when I started freelancing. But I was doing every Manchester United game. I'm not a Manchester United fan. I admire so much about the club, about its history, but they're not my team. But when you're doing the same team over and over again, and I was working with Frank Stapleton, who can't speak highly enough about, as a broadcaster and as a bloke, fantastic. He obviously, as a Manchester United player, ex-Manchester United player, was very much pro United, and so you get caught up in it. So I was ostensibly neutral for that game, but I wasn't really. I wanted United to win. I was broadcasting for a Northwest based audience, so I didn't have to play it down the middle. It didn't have to be any pretense that we weren't cheerleaders for Manchester United, but it's obvious that the majority of the audience were tuning in because they wanted United to win. So that was the way we pitched it, and certainly going into every game, but that game, there was a feeling, okay, we hope that Manchester United win. From a selfish point of view, I wanted them to win. I'd never commentated on an FA Cup final, and if they won, I'd be going to Wembley and commentating at Wembley. I'd been to Wembley as a supporter. I've been to Wembley in a professional capacity, reporting on games, but I'd never commentated at Wembley. So this was a big deal for me as well. And so it was very important from a very selfish point of view that United won that game, and very important for every Manchester United fan from a completely different perspective that they won that game. But obviously, just to contextualise the situation at the stage of the semi-final, it looked as though they were going to win the league. Nothing was guaranteed, but they got every chance of winning the league. They were still in the latter stages of Europe, and the treble was on. The treble was very much being talked about by then, and it wouldn't take much for the treble dream to go.
So before we get into the actual moment then, we'll just give some more background to the game itself. So when, because it is now in folklore in terms of what Giggs did that night, but as we'll come on to, there's so much more around that game. What time did you get to the ground? What at that time? And were you aware that something, because just to remind people, it was at Villa Park. Were you aware of something? Did the air have a crackle in it? Was there something special?
Yes, very definitely. Very definitely. We, Frank and I met in Birmingham, beat the traffic. Obviously, he was coming down from the northwest. I'd gone up to Birmingham. I'd worked in Birmingham, been brought up there, knew the city very well. Nice little Italian restaurant for a very early tea at about 4 o'clock. Now, we didn't really say too much to each other. Big match nerves, really. I mean, from my point of view, from as a young broadcaster, it was an FA Cup semi-final. I've done the first game at the weekend, so it wasn't the first one I'd done, but it was, you know, it was still a very big occasion, one of the biggest games I'd ever done, one of the most important games I'd ever done because of the context of United's season. And there was a real feeling that this is just going to be a special night. And you don't get that feeling very often, but it's funny, when you do, and you sort of sit there with almost an air of trepidation, you know that it's just not going to be a mundane, routine night at the office, that there was a feeling that something special would happen. That had been set up by the first game. I don't really remember a lot about the first game. I don't think anybody does. But the second game was just remarkable. Remarkable. And it was an epic encounter. I mean, it would still be one of the best five or six games that I've ever been to. And I think that great sporting moments in isolation are fantastic, but they're only really great sporting moments if the context and the importance of them is right, as well as the technical brilliance of what you see. Wayne Rooney's fantastic overhead goal for United was a stunning goal. Would it be remembered as fondly if it hadn't happened against City in a derby at Old Trafford? Probably not. And it's the same with this Ryan Giggs goal. It's a great goal, but what makes it great is that United weren't winning that game. They were under the cosh. They had 10 men. They were in trouble. They were getting battered. And it's that time that he's able to produce that moment of brilliance that makes it what it is.
when you're there, how was the ground? Can you remember how the ground was set up? Because if I remember right, the goal scorer is scored at the Holt End.
Yes.
So who had the Holt End? Was it Arsenal or was it United? How was the ground? Was there a good mix? It was a good split of the ground.
Now, again, I stand to be corrected. My memory of it is that Arsenal would have had the Holt End. The United had the Doug Ellis stand. So that is the one. If you can visualise the goal being scored, if the goal was scored away to our right hand side,
as the commentator,
as I was looking, I think the TV cameras in those days were on the other side.
Yeah, it's always to the left.
So where I was, it was to the right, and so the stand where the TV cameras were in, mm-hmm. that's where United were.
Okay.
So they are looking to their left, as the TV cameras were as he scores, and then he wheels away and runs down towards the touchline, and that's the touchline the United fans were on. That's my memory of it.
So he's literally got the United fans at his back driving, yeah. and that's kind of almost metaphorical of they're at his back, and that's an interesting one. But we're gonna talk now about probably the most crucial elements of the goal, Peter Schmeichel.
Absolutely. Well, this gets forgotten about, I think. I mean, the United fans may say, no, of course it doesn't get forgotten about. I think in the wider context it gets forgotten about. Giggs only scores that goal because of Peter Schmeichel. United only win the treble because of Peter Schmeichel. Because what had led up to the Ryan Giggs goal was United dominating, taking the lead through Beckham in the first half. Roy Keane getting sent off. Bergkamp equalising. And then Phil Neville, who came in for Dennis Irwin, gave away a penalty in stoppage time at the end of the 90 minutes. Now this is it. This is the treble dream, which was still very much nascent at that point. But this is the treble dream there on the line. It's Bergkamp against Schmeichel. And if he doesn't save it, that's it. It's over. Because there's no time for United to come back. This is in stoppage time at the end of the 90 minutes. Extra time if they can get over this hurdle. And Schmeichel produces a fantastic penalty save. It wasn't a great penalty from Bergkamp, but it just produces a fantastic save. And ordinarily you think, watching, oh, that's it then. That's it. The game's turned. Well, it didn't. All it did was prolong it for half an hour. And United were hanging on with really camped inside their own half. Couldn't get a kick, couldn't get out. And then there's this straight pass in the midfield from Patrick Vieira. And Ryan Giggs picks up the ball. And my first thought was, well, this is going to waste a little bit of time. They're going to be able to just get, it's a breather for the defenders because they're actually going to get over the halfway line, they're going to be able to get into Arsenal territory. And he's still got the ball. And he's still going. And then he's getting towards the edge of the penalty area. And Lee Dixon's going to try and challenge him. And he's unleashed this fierce shot. And just the camera catches this look of almost shock on David Seaman's face at the pace which this is coming to him, and the angle, Seaman's body's almost contorted because he's had to adjust the trajectory of the save he's trying to make mid-flight because of the speed of it. It's like, to use a cricketing analogy, all of a sudden someone puts the fastball down 20 miles an hour faster than what he's been bowling before, and it's a bounce and it's coming at your head, and you're having to like sort of duck out of the way at the last moment. Now, David Seaman wasn't trying to duck out of the way, he was trying to make the save, but it was just the realisation that it was getting big on him really quickly, and he couldn't make the save as it went past him into the roof of the net. And all hell broke loose.
Is it, the question I want to ask though is that in between, and this is from your memory of it, in between all of that and that literal, because on the TV, you hear, as far as I remember, you actually hear the ball hit the net. Now, I don't know if you'd have heard that in the ground, but you hear the ball in there. So from that split second, from there to the bedlam, what is the reaction around you? I mean, as you're saying, you've got Frank Stapleton next to you, who obviously isn't going to be neutral in this instance. Now, what is that reaction? What's the reaction around you in the press boxes, in the commentary, in the gantries? That split second between the ball hitting the net and Bedlam.
Jaws dropped. I mean, I think that's fair to say. I don't remember what Frank said. Being the consummate broadcaster that he is, he certainly wouldn't have shouted. I've worked with plenty of people that wouldn't have been able to contain themselves at a moment like that. Frank, to his eternal credit, didn't spoil the moment by interjecting in any way. At least I don't think he did. I'm sure he didn't. But it's like a snapshot in time, a freeze frame, and straight away the magnitude of it is apparent. Clearly they haven't won the game at this stage, because they've got, is it another 10 minutes they've got to hang on in extra time, and they're still playing with 10 men, and they're still going to be under the cosh. So they haven't won anything. But you know, when you see that moment, you just know, well, I've witnessed something special. They'll be talking about that for years. And you don't see that many sporting moments unfold before you. But you know straight away, that's just an iconic moment. That will be talked about. My kids will talk about that. My grandchildren will see that moment. And it's so immediately apparent that is the case. I can't remember what I said. I certainly wouldn't want to hear my commentary of it again, because I will definitely have gone completely over the top, and I won't have been able to do the moment justice. It would have been loud.
Yeah.
He's whipped the shirt off, and it's the iconic celebration as well, because everyone thinks of the goal, but you think of, or I think of, the him turning away with the shirt off, the grey shirt off, and windmilling it round his head as he runs down towards that touchline where the Manchester United fans are. And you know, any United fan listening to this will instantly, won't have to think about it, will instantly just be able to close their eyes and see it's there. They can picture it, they can almost sort of smell the atmosphere of that time. And of course, as it turned out, what made it so special was what that meant in conjunction with the Schmeichel penalty save, that got them through an extraordinarily difficult hurdle. They won the league relatively routinely, although I know it went to the final day and it wasn't even a formality on the final day, but they won the league. Newcastle in the FA Cup final was not anything so arduous a task as Arsenal. I mean, the semi-final was the final before the final.
Yeah, bit of an anticlimax, wasn't it?
And obviously, the Champions League final was another extraordinary chapter with the way that they won that. But the treble only came about because of those two moments, the Schmeichel save and that remarkable goal.
It'd be an interesting question to put to any of those teams, any of those players in that 1919. But do you think the Arsenal semi-final kind of gave the United players belief in the new camp, that they would, hang on, we've been here before?
Absolutely. I think that definitely would have galvanised them. They would, I would imagine that they would have thought, right, this is on now. We can do this. I mean, they would have been odds on for the double as soon as they'd won that night. But yeah, we can do this, and this is something that we can draw upon, you know, in the future, that we're never out of game, no matter how bad the situation looks. Even if we're facing a penalty with effectively the last kick of the game, you know, we can override this kind of situation. So I'm sure that it was a galvanising moment for them all, for him individual, but for all individually, but for all the other players as well. No doubt about that.
And you talk about the fans who have a snapshot, and people, you know, I've got the memory of the gigs as well. I haven't got the memory of gigs
of the chest
and all the chest wig and all that. But when you sit back and you think and you look, what is your snapshot of that goal? Is it Seaman's head nearly being taken off? Is it Giggs turning? Is it Lee Dixon coming out at 90-degree angles with his legs because he's just been?
I think it's the actual shot. I think it's the ball leaving his foot, and it's funny because I've seen it obviously so many times, I only saw it the once from the angle that I was sitting in the stadium. I've seen it so many times from the other angle. So your memory of it kind of becomes transposed by the TV pictures. But I can see it a lot more clearly in my mind from having seen countless replays of it over the years. But my memory of it from the time is a little bit more hazy. But it's just the speed of the ball leaving his foot. Just the run. Only from about sort of 5 yards from the edge of the penalty area, really. Because, as I say, at that stage, it just seems as though, oh, is it a chance to ease the pressure? But then I can picture in my mind's eye now, five yards outside the penalty area, making the ground towards the edge of the box, and then the speed of the ball leaving his foot, and David Seaman sort of head almost jerked back as the ball beat him. I'm in an extremely fortunate position to do what I do for a living. I'm not going to see many more moments like that. In some ways I wouldn't want to, because you don't want, if you got a moment like that every season, it would dilute away from the importance of it.
Yeah.
But you know, here we are. I've had four kids since then. That's why I'm working hard. I've had a fantastic time since then, and yet a team that I don't support still have conjured up one of the most intense moments of my life.